Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. I'm the beverage director for the Epicurean Group of Restaurants and Epicurean Events. And today we have on an exciting guest. We have Katie Parla on today. Katie is by all means an expert in everything when it comes to food and drink. Italy, especially in Rome. She has her bachelor's degree from Yale, but she got her master's in Rome and has written for tons of great publications like Travel and Leisure, Afar, Bon Appetit, Food and Wine, New York Times, and some you might have heard of as well. I mean, pretty much everyone. She's on TV all the time. She's on National Geographic. She has a web series called Katie Parla's Rome, a blog, an app. Katie, what don't you do? You sound like a very, very busy lady.
Well, don't worry. I still find time to drink, so.
Okay. So I want to talk to you about how obviously you're an American.
Yes, from Jersey.
From New Jersey, who traveled to Italy and fell in love with it. I did the same, but some New York pulled me back.
It's an appealing city. I understand it.
and you stayed there. Obviously, you split your time now between the States, some time in London. You also do some travel writing on London and Istanbul. Mm-hmm. But it seems like Rome is your focus.
Definitely. I mean, I moved to Rome with this idea that it was going to be a place that sort of satisfied all my senses. And the more time I spent there, the less it lived up to the mythological expectations that I had. So, I mean, in a sense, it was the art and architecture that attracted me, but the food and beverage, and above all, the changing food and beverage that kept me there, that still keeps me there. I want to document what's going on right now. And I think, you know, contemporary Rome cuisine and beverage is something that really remains quite obscure to most visitors.
Yeah, so. And so you did your undergrad in art history, correct?
Yeah, but eating lots of pizza all the time in New Haven. many pizzas.
And, you know, I took an art history class in Florence, so obviously, not my major or anything, but what struck me was when you're in Italy, and I'm sure this is the case in many European countries, but you know, Italy was my experience, you can view art in the place that it was meant to go there.
Absolutely.
You know, here, when we view art, a lot of times it's in a gallery or a museum, out of context, but there it's like this is exactly how they intended for it to be viewed.
Yeah, and there's so many exciting places where you can see frescoes and altarpieces in situ. Though there are plenty of examples in Rome where works have been taken out of their context, put in a museum setting, some successful, some less successful in terms of display and experience. But yeah, I mean, you're in essence, whether you're living in Rome or Venice or Milan or Florence, you're living in a living museum.
Mm-hmm. And so how long did it take for you to feel like you were, you know, part of it? Did you feel like that Rome was the place that you were meant to be, or did you feel like you were out of context for a while?
I mean, I always felt like it was the place that I had to live. I think when I first moved there, I felt like I could assimilate somehow. Mm-hmm. But the more time I spent, the more my American character sort of asserted itself. And, you know, I recognize that in Italy, as you know from living in Florence, people are extremely regionally based. So unless you're born or at least raised most of your time in a city, you're never actually adopted into that city. Though, you know, I constantly encounter people who say like, oh, I'm from Rome, like seven generations Roman. And then you find out that their grandparents or their parents are from Abruzzo. And it's like there is this desire to be part of that place to the point that people fabricate their own biographies. But, you know, I was never able to do that. So And I like walking the line between both places because I feel very integrated into Italian gastronomic culture. I love being in situ to consume the foods and mm-hmm. drinks from there. But I also look at the place with an outsider's eye, an analytical eye, one that even some of the greatest food critics and wine writers in Italy sometimes aren't able to do. They're clouded by their nationalism or regional pride, and I don't buy into that. So,
yeah, and just going by what you said, I had stayed in Rome with a friend who was writing for the Gambero Rosso, and he lived very close to this fantastic pizzeria. I'm sure you know it, called Pizzarium.
Oh yeah,
kind of in the residential area behind the Vatican. Mm-hmm. And every day, he lived above this great cafe. I went every single morning, and it wasn't until the third or fourth day that they acknowledged me. Mm-hmm. And then by the fifth day, they were asking me questions, and the sixth day, it was I'm a regular and part of it. I mean, just as a foreigner traveling abroad, I search for that feeling as part of it. But I totally get what you see about people that. Distinct character that, especially in Rome.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, I think you touch on an important notion there. It doesn't take long to become a regular at a Roman cocktail bar, at a pizzeria, at a cafe. And you can very easily sort of become sort of part of the culture, but you're never really let in fully. Mm-hmm. And, as a foreigner living in Rome, I love going to the same, pubs or cocktail bars over and over again. As a person who wants to inform people about food and drink, I like to highlight the great cocktail bars of Rome, but with caveats. Do go to Dal Verme for a cocktail, but do not go on Monday because the great bartenders aren't there. Or don't go before 9 o'clock because even though they open at 8, they're not set up and they'll end up serving you something ridiculous just in haste. So, I think that sort of plays back into the being a regular, but then also having the ability to take a step back.
That's great. I mean, that's the kind of advice that you're not going to see in a normal kind of travel guide. That's someone who's living there, who really knows the ins and outs.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the UK publications that I'm writing for recently want to hear the bad side, things with a negative spin, whereas U.S. publications want all of the sort of
that's
more
interesting.
Positive.
I wonder what it is about their culture. You come from the restaurant industry. I like to read restaurant reviews, mm-hmm. And U.K. restaurant reviews, bad ones, have this certain type of venom that you just don't get out of a U.S.-based restaurant review.
Yeah, I mean, completely. Jay Rayner's vitriol reaches unbelievable peaks, and it's super entertaining, but also a little bit jarring, especially if you compare it to other sort of national journalistic approaches.
Yeah. And what was the moment? So did you go to Italy thinking that you were going to surround yourself by art, or was food the primary goal when you were there?
I thought I was going to go spend a lot of time looking at second century sarcophagi. That was what I was way into. I still am totally into that subject. But I grew up in a restaurant family. I was always super interested in food, mm-hmm. Always questioning what we were eating. I'm from New Jersey, so the Garden State, why we were eating certain things, contemplating seasons, even before, in the 90s when I was thinking about these things. And then when I went over to Italy, it was only natural that food became the lens through which I analyzed the rest of the culture, particularly as I traveled from Rome to Naples, to Bari, to Lecce, to Palermo, and saw the huge differences in culture, even though there were often very common historical elements. So, yeah, I mean, food and, of course, wine and much later craft beer. Which only sort of becomes a thing in Italy in a significant way in 2009 and onwards. Those became the tools that I used for interpreting the Italian food culture, regional food culture.
And then in order to kind of create this job for yourself where you're constantly writing and you're on TV and your blog and your app, and how did that all come about?
So the TV stuff is actually quite separate. It's connected to a degree that I did in archaeological spelunking. There are tons of caves in Rome and all sorts of like gross sewers and awesome
I'm very familiar with archaeological spelunking, as a matter of fact. No, that's
indeed,
crazy. I've never heard of that.
There's a vast network of people in New York that, you know, go trespassing in subway tunnels and like water conduits and things. Well, just imagine doing the same thing in Rome, but you're in an aqueduct from, you know, the 2nd century BC or the Cloaca Maxima, which is from 600 BC. So through that, I ended up working on producing and being featured in five episodes of Cities of the Underworld, which was on the History Channel. And then, I mean, it's all about like sort of word of mouth. So then other productions called. The other things, like the writing was really developed out of my master's degree. I studied Italian gastronomic culture, and I wanted to analyze 21st century food in Rome. At the time, this is going maybe like 6 years back or so, no one wanted to hear about contemporary food. And still a lot of publications and people don't want to know about what's going on. Modern or contemporary food in Rome is not molecular. It's not radical. But it is part of this evolution of cuisine that reflects what's going on in Italy right now. 2000 marked this turning point in the economy, in culture, and the food has reflected that. So my blog was really born, and then the writing that comes out of the blog, were really born to express what was going on. The blog became a place where I could write things that no one would pay me to publish. and I, you know, a lot of journalist bloggers have that issue. You've got all these great stories that you want to get out there, but in essence, they're not right. They're not timely, even though they're important. And then the apps, I've got now two, soon to be three, Katie Parla's Rome and Katie Parla's Istanbul, were born out of that same desire to like highlight what was going on at the moment and to have a product that was released and then constantly updated in a way that the books I was writing, the guidebooks and travel guides and things like that, couldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, just being able to give visitors to Rome a really unique and authentic view of what is actually happening in Rome or Istanbul in the case of the other app. And it's been really exciting because people are able to go to places that they otherwise wouldn't have felt comfortable visiting. And that keeps those small businesses who are terrible at communicating and posting their hours and like being open when they're supposed to be, that keeps them going.
Yeah.
So,
well, I wish that I had Katie Parla's Rome, that the app, last time. I've been to Rome four times, and it would have really come in handy. You know, especially with these more modern restaurants, because I find that personally, I'm more drawn to that sense of typical or traditional food in the area, especially in Italy. I think I've been to a couple of restaurants that have tried to push the envelope and have sort of failed miserably. I'm like, oh, why didn't I just go to a simple trattoria and have something a little bit more soulful?
Yeah.
But describe a little bit more what is going on for these people who aren't going the molecular gastronomy route, but are making modern, up-to-date restaurants.
So when I think of contemporary cuisine in Rome, a few things come to mind. One is like the more economical sort of street food. Where you have people using really good flours for their breads. Like when you went to Pizzarium, that pizza by the slice is made with really great ingredients.
I love that place.
That's an innovation in Roman
street
food.
It's not
like
traditional.
No one's using good stuff except for a handful of people.
Yeah, he opened it, he was saying, because he found that there was no good pizza Italia, which is pizza by the slice. It was all just like mass industrially produced from like bad ingredients.
Of course.
And he like, you know, used good flour, seasonal ingredients, let the dough raise for like 7 weeks or something, no, 2 days or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, that approach, that is 21st century cuisine. That's not molecular. That's not doing anything that's like changing Italian cuisine in general, but it is creating a new way to eat in a city, which has really provincial characteristics, but is in fact a metropolis. I mean, there are estimated 2.5-3 million people in Rome. Some say 4 million. Depending on who's counting, the census sort of says otherwise. But so that's one good example, like this affordable, quality-driven street food. And you see that at like Trapizzino, which is a very new place that has made Roman secondi. So like oxtail or chicken with peppers, portable. People can't afford to go out to lunch every day like they used to. You know, like before the euro, a lot of people had those like tickets that bureaucrats would get, the vouchers for meals, and you'll be able to go out and have a pretty good meal for lunch and feel satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
that's not the case anymore.
Is that also because maybe Rome is becoming a little bit more modern, a little more Western, and people aren't doing 2 and 3 hour lunches?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that people work has really changed. And yeah. If you look at like the number of unemployed people under the age of 25, that whole market is like absent. People aren't going out and spending money at lunchtime or dinner time. So there's this new niche between the unemployed or the underemployed, and then generally people who are employed but don't have the funds to support the dining culture as it used to be. As you know, on your last trip, probably people were going out more. Every year there's a decline in how people eat at restaurants. So in like Trapizzino or at Mortier Vai, which is in the new Testaccio market, you've got these places that are making sandwiches stuffed with Roman second courses. This is not a radical change. I mean, this isn't something that would blow people away in another city, but in Rome, it's an innovation and it makes something that feels hearty and satisfying and it's cheap. Anyone can afford it. And so that's really new. And then, at the restaurant table, you could still find a few trattorias in Rome that are using decent ingredients. There aren't that many. But you see, I mean, when you have like your contorno, your vegetable side dish, mm-hmm. like compare what you had 10 years ago to what's on your plate today. It's totally different. There's no flavor. There's no sense of seasonality in most places. You can get your braised artichokes year-round when really it's from February to May that the Roman globe artichoke is in season. That's when it has the most flavor. That's when it's the most life-changing. But people are responding to tourist demand, local demand, the locals' abandoning of seasonal produce or their love of it. So at like the restaurant table, you can go to places like Roscioli. So this place does a lot of dishes. There are certain dishes that they do really, really well, like their carbonara, which uses really high quality durum wheat pasta, and a really nice artisanal guanciale, which is cured pork gel. They use black pepper from Malaysia. They use eggs from Paolo Parisi, which in my opinion, and I probably could get sued for this if I said this in Italy, is a bit of a scam. They're eggs that are $20 a dozen, $20 equivalent a dozen, and this Tuscan pseudo farmer feeds goat's milk to his Livorno hens, and they're wildly expensive. But all of these things combined together taste really, really good. Also, there's fantastic pecorino from Brunelli, which is mm-hmm. a Roman producer, super salty. So the sourcing of ingredients, I mean, something that's been a discussion in, you know, on the coasts in the U.S. for so long, is something that is contemporary in some parts of Roman cuisine.
That's good to know. Yeah. All right, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Katie about what the Romans are drinking, especially at these new restaurants.
You are listening to Radio Raw by Obesity here on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Proud to announce our Heritage Rare Breed Chicken Rotation. We've partnered with Frank Rees, the country's preeminent poultry farmer, to create an alternative market for non-industry bred chicken and show our customers what real chicken tastes like. Frank's chickens look and taste different from commodity poultry. They have not been genetically manipulated or pumped with antibiotics to increase their growth rate. Frank breeds and hatches his own birds so he can guarantee the finest animal welfare from start to finish. Every 3 months, Heritage Foods USA will offer a new, rare breed of chicken on our website and at the Heritage Meat Shop. Our inaugural variety is the Colombian Wyandotte, These birds are good for frying and are sought after for their fine texture, taste, and healthy lipid fine yellow fat. Heritage Foods USA is the only place you can taste these special heritage birds. Order today at heritagefoodsusa.com.
We're back on In the Drink. Thanks, Frank, for taking good care of your chickens. I'm here with Katie Parla. And Katie, so you were telling us about what's going on with the food, the changing kind of food culture in Rome. Tell us about what's going on with the drink culture. You know, I'm particularly interested in the aperitivo hour, which obviously it's something that started. I guess that the hour part is something that I added in the American, but the aperitivo culture is something that started further up north in Milan, and it kind of has made its way to most major cities. Aperitivo is the time before dinner, when restaurants and bars and cafes will put out some food, and the food is free if you order drinks. Now sometimes they're really sad, and sometimes they can be really good. One plate maximum.
Yeah, they keep track.
One plate per drink. Is that
one plate per drink? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a Roman thing, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah, because Romans abuse it. They abuse the buffet.
I'm definitely guilty of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the aperitivo certainly has changed over the decade that I've been in Rome. And it used to be a cheap way for students to eat. I mean, there are like well over 100,000 students in Rome, the University of Rome. There are multiple universities of Rome, plus, you know, all the American foreign campuses. There were a lot of kids that needed to eat cheap on a budget and wanted to drink with it. And so places like, especially in Trastevere or, the area around the university, like Piazza Bologna area, would have, you know, you go get a spritz or a bad mojito or something like that for €8. And then you have access to a massive buffet populated with pasta salads and, lots of terrible couscous and like gross stuff. In my opinion, I mean, you don't go to the aperitivo to have like a fine, delicious experience. You go there to fill up on carbs and to drink something that's not very well made. That was in the past. There are now some examples of great happy hours. And people do use the word happy hour, though they spell it phonetically, apiaura, starting with an A, API. and so you can go to a place in the center of Rome, like Barnum Cafe, and get a really well-made drink with some decent snacks. There's a place in Pignato that opened in November or December called Coso, and they serve very, very edible snacks along with their quite creative cocktails. The Dome Hotel, which is this like super luxurious five-star in Via Giulia, so right in the center of Rome, they serve ample snacks with their drinks. So you have to go later in the happy hour hours, because the happy hour in Rome lasts from like 6 to 9 p.m. Because that's when the well-trained bartender is working. If you go earlier, you get like the worst, most expensive drink.
I'm pleasantly surprised to hear you use the words creative cocktails when describing a cocktail in Italy, because I haven't really come across too much of that. Tell us what's going on. Are there people who are embracing the, you know, the boutique, the craft cocktail movement? And
yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there are two schools. There are places like Barnum Cafe or the Gin Corner or the long established Jerry Thomas Project that are looking to prohibition and pre-prohibition cocktails. They're deriving a lot of their menu from American cocktail culture of the early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century. And then you have the more creative cocktails. Coso, which I mentioned, wants to do a good drink, but they also want to root their drinks in Rome. They want to make their cocktails feel Roman. So their vodka sour is called a carbonara sour. And they use like fat washed vodka and coarsely ground black pepper, egg white instead of egg yolk, which is one of the components of carbonara. So they want to do something that's like a bit creative, a little tongue in cheek, and fun. And the place is like totally funky, and they can certainly serve you like a very classic Sazerac, but they're more interested in playing with flavors and garnishes and things like this. So it's part of this sort of new phase in Roman cocktail culture to make the craft cocktails feel more Roman.
Now, is this a movement? Is this something that there's more than just a couple of players doing it? Or is it really just these few that you mentioned as the kind of pioneers?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really reached critical mass citywide, but in the past, 18 months, and especially in the past 3 months, a lot of places have opened. Like, the Gin Corner opened in June, and they have 80 gins. Like, no place in Italy has 80 gins. So this is pretty impressive. Barnum Cafe does amazing cocktails. They do a lot of classic stuff. They opened a year ago. The Hotel Majestic Bar is run by Emanuele Brocatelli, who did the cocktail menus at Cafe Propaganda and Stazione di Posta. You've got Litro, which is a mezcal bar, and they do lots of mezcal cocktails. These are all really new things. And in Rome, we don't generally see such a relatively large number of places doing that same sort of similar genre opening all at the same time. So there is something driving this.
Absolutely blown my mind to know that there's mezcal. You can find mezcal in Rome.
It's awesome. Yeah. So great. Finally.
Usually, I mean, couldn't even find a bottle of wine from a neighboring region, you know, so to find mezcal is, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's super exciting, and also the wine culture is changing. I mean,
yeah, let's talk about the wine culture. Here in New York, we get very few wines from the region of Lazio that are imported, which is surprising to me. And on one hand, because of it's a kind of vast region that has a very, very long history of making wine since at least the ancient Roman times, right? But on the other hand, what I always tell people is that there's a quite a local market with a large city, big population, lots of tourism, and so they tend to suck up a lot of their own wine. And then there aren't, at least from what I can tell, a lot of very small boutique producers. We get a couple here in the States. I can think of a few that we have on our list, like Le Coste, Damiano Cioli, and Occhi Pinti, different Occhi Pinti from the...
Andrea Occhi Pinti.
Yeah, Andrea instead of Arianna. But not, we don't get a ton of great Lazio wines. Is there a disconnect? Are there tons of small producers who are making great wine in Lazio and we just don't see them here in the States? Or is it still evolving?
It's still changing. There are some really great producers that are doing wines not for a Roman public. I mean, Le Coste sells some Litrozzo in and around Rome, but the market for that wine is in London. It's in mm-hmm. Sydney. It's in New York. Los Angeles even. And so you have certainly a local consumption of wines, and there are several places in the city of Rome that only serve local wines. And people are very open to drinking very simple wines based on Trebbiano, Malvasia, Cesenese.
Like Frascati is the most famous and historic wine.
Right.
But is there a delicious Frascati? Is there someone who's making a really well-made artisanal Frascati?
Oh man, I mean,
maybe. Oh no, if you don't know, then we're all doomed.
I know. I don't tend to drink a lot of Frascati. When I want to drink something that's Frascati is a DOCG, and I think, you know, we can talk for ages about the questionability of rankings like this. Frascati is perfectly drinkable in many of its finer forms, but it's not something that I crave. If I want a wine that feels rooted in Lazio, and something simple and that's really readily available both in the U.S. as well as in Rome, I'll go for Marco Carpinetti. Organic producer, he does a lot of Bellone-based wines, mm-hmm. Nice, fresh, good acid, nice structure, white wines. He's also working with Nero Buono and Cori. So those are the sort of simpler wines that I go for. Le Coste, so Clementine and Gianmarco up near Lake Bolzano in Gradoli are doing a lot of skin contact wines with mixtures of all sorts of indigenous white grapes that are allowed in several of the appellations up there. But so much of that is either consumed in the trattorias that are buddies with the winemakers or shipped abroad. And, you know, London consumes a lot of that. There's a huge natural wine, mm-hmm. especially Italian natural wine interest in London.
Yeah, I was just in Orvieto, and it's like, all right, I'm going to drink some cheap Palo Bea. It's going to be great. And there's no Palo Bea in Orvieto. It's all exported.
So I'm always terrible at pronouncing the name of the monastery that Giampiero Bea works with, the Monastero Suore Cistercens.
Cistercensi.
Yeah, the Cistercensi nuns.
Yes.
They make about 12,000 bottles of their Cenobium. And 80% of that is shipped to the United States.
I love that wine.
It's so good. It's super good. You can not find it in Rome because there is no local interest in it. It's too funky. Difficult wine. It's funky. It's not something that people want to drink with the food that is served in Rome. So you'll have more luck finding like quality, but more mainstream, like Casale de Lioria, Marco Carpinetti. I mean, certainly Damiano Cholli. Another sort of mind-boggling thing, well, not particularly mind-boggling if you know the story behind Fiorano, is that you cannot find Fiorano pre-95 wines in Rome. I mean, they're all in New York. So you have really these exceptional opportunities to drink Lazio wines.
We have like 5 or 6 different SKUs of Fiorano pre-1995 at our restaurants.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone should go drink them because they're impossible to find. They're super rare, and you know, like they retail for around like $125. The prices that I've seen at restaurants are very reasonable. I mean, the markup's not triple or anything. These are like fantastic, brilliant, age-worthy wines. Probably like the 95s have another 10, 15, 20 years in the cellar to go. So I wouldn't be popping any of those bottles. But yeah, like we can't get some of these really exceptional things that are total anomalies in Lazio because, as you know, so many of the producers in Lazio, especially the ones in Rome, and Fiorano is sort of on the cusp of the metropolitan area, didn't really have a local audience except for some really fine restaurants that have drunk up all the bottles.
And one last topic, you alluded to it before, but the beer culture in Rome. I always say when I'm talking about Italian beer that of all of the places in the world that produce beer, I think that Italy has the most exciting beer culture, maybe outside of the United States, but because they've, in a way, taken all of the traditional styles of beer and say, we don't care. Like, we're just going to come up with completely new shit ourselves and be, you know, use all of our inherent creativity and apply that to the realm of beer.
Yeah, it's so amazing because there are so many of these artisan crafts that are dying. The creativity is leaving a lot of industries. And it feels like it's all being concentrated in the beer industry because you have exceptional American or UK or Belgian inspired beers or things that are totally new. And right now, like actually at the end of January, anyone who's headed to Rome should look for this beer. It won't be around for long. It sells out pretty quickly, but Beer del Borgo, which is a brewery not far from Rome, makes an oyster stout. They use French oysters and Roman bean clams in the brewing process. So you get this really super sapid, really delicate but complicated beer that is just stunning. Some of it gets exported to the U.S., though, because the distribution is so limited, it's difficult to find. So check that out when you're in Rome and head to, like, Open Baladine. Ma che siete venuti a fa usually has some. Certainly you can buy it at Domus Birrae, one of the leading beer shops.
And has the Roman market really embraced these kind of more creative beers?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. Rome is the Italian craft beer consumption capital. Most people are still drinking Peroni. Most people are still spending nationwide. Most families are still spending their 12 euros a month on wine, their 6 euros a month on beer, which is not the population that is drinking these beers and wines and cocktails that I alluded to before. But there is a small but growing group of people who's interested in something that's quality, something that is different, something that still mirrors the territory where it comes from, but is certainly a break with maybe the more run-of-the-mill tradition.
All right. Katie Parla, what a blast having you on the show.
It was so fun. Thanks so much for having me.
Next time you guys go to Rome, London, or Istanbul, check out Katie Parla's apps, Katie Parla's blog. I for sure will be. You just like re-inspired my desire to go back to Rome as soon as possible.
Book your tickets. Sir.
Really, especially before artichoke season is over. Thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.